This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have the great pleasure of talking to Senator Bill Bradley, whose new book is called We Can All Do Better. Senator Bradley, nice to have you on. Thank you for doing this.
David, thank you so much for having me on.
So are you now kind of on a book tour? Are you going around promoting the book?
Yes, I am. Yes, as we're speaking today, I'm actually in Chicago.
I did see you on, I can't remember which, it's some television show I happened to be watching, I think it was on MSNBC the other day, where you were interviewed. It wasn't specifically about the book, but I imagine that this book is kind of bringing you back into the public conversation.
Well, that's true, yes. If you write a book, you want it read, and so I'm out talking about it. Tonight I'll be at the Chicago Public Library.
Which is a great place, by the way. A beautiful
I'm
room.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I've been to some events there, and it is absolutely spectacular. Well, I guess I'm curious to talk to you about a few of the issues that are in the book. I think from the title, I take off from that it's a kind of positivist approach, and yet, you know, we're in an era when I think a lot of the public discourse about politics is extremely negative rather than positive. And I think there's a certain feeling that a lot of people have who are interested in the future of the country and the politics of how we go forward, who feel that it's almost impossible to imagine bridging the gulf between what you call the two different ethics between Republicans and Democrats. You called it, I thought, you know, very succinctly, the caring ethos of the Democrats and the personal responsibility ethos of the Republicans. So my long question, lead-up question to you is, essentially, how do we bridge the gulf between two essentially different worldviews?
Well, I think that's actually one of the reasons that I wrote the book. I wanted to give people hope that that was possible and remind them that we've been in difficult situations in the past, depressions, wars, obvious flaws in our democracy, and we've overcome them all and moved on. And I wanted to remind people that our political institutions are flexible enough to allow us to address our problems, and that the foundation upon which all of our answers have to come is with the belief that there's a goodness in the American people and other directedness, and it's key that we understand that as we're formulating our answers. Specifically, how do you bridge the gap between Republicans and Democrats, or as I say, the ethic of caring associated with collective action in Democrats and the ethic of responsibility, individual action associated with Republicans, is to point out that we need both. You can't just have one or the other. One of the deficiencies of our politics is that the choice is given as an either-or when it's really a both. For example, take health. Collective caring would say that we need to have everybody in America with access to quality health care. But individual responsibility would say you really have to take care of your own body, yeah, by what you eat, by what you how you exercise. And the healthier you are because you take care of your body, the less you'll cost the healthcare system and the more money will be available for other people to get health insurance. And the same applies to pensions. I mean, collective caring would say that we have to make sure everybody has Social Security and that it's protected. 35% of the elderly today, that's their only pension. But individual responsibility would say, in addition to Social Security, it's kind of up to the individual to set aside a little bit to save. And that's when they'll have a better retirement. So we need both individual responsibility and collective caring in order to have a country that goes into the 21st century as a unified whole.
Well, I think that's rational. I think that makes sense. But how do you deal with what looks like to many people a toxic atmosphere where, you know, every politician who's act, or, well, not every, but almost every politician, when they're asked questions, will lead off by blaming the other party for whatever has
Well,
happened.
I think you do that in two ways. One is when you talk about the problems we face, you connect the dots, as I just try to do, how one is related to the other. I think that's critical. And then it's with the realization that there have been times in American history when political points of view have been irreconcilable. And usually, that means that there's tremendous conflict. The irreconcilable point, the time that comes to mind for me when they were really irreconcilable was right before the Civil War. But absent that, it's political conflict. It's often vicious, but bloodless. And ultimately, one of three things happen. You either have one party win overwhelmingly and adopt their agenda, or you have, as it was during the 18 years I was in the United States Senate, it'd be a narrow majority, and therefore, if you're going to get anything done, you have to have bipartisanship. Or the third alternative is that neither of those produce the kind of results that people want, is there's emergence of a third party. And I would suggest here it would be a third congressional party that would lay out a very specific agenda on the items that are most important to people, like the income of the middle class Americans, like deficit reduction, like how to repair the flaws in our democracy, particularly the role of money in politics and how destructive that is. And that congressional party could, if it ran in 50 districts, 50 competitive districts and won 20, it would have 20 seats in the Congress, and that would be at the fulcrum of power, and they'd be able to trade votes in order to get the people's agenda passed as opposed to the agenda of the narrow interests.
Right, which what you're describing is something much more like the parliamentary situations in Europe and Israel and many other countries around the world, where there are multiple parties that have to negotiate amongst themselves to come up with the political ability to rule, to govern.
No,
So.
yeah, there's no question about that. But obviously, my preference would be for the Democrats to wipe the floor with the Republicans. But absent that, that's where I see things headed.
Well, so, and you talked about that in the book, and I was kind of interested in that because you referenced a an online organization that has been working toward creating a third party by using the internet. And one of the questions I had, since obviously the book was written a few months ago, and I, you know, before, I'm not quite sure when you went to press or when you finalized your manuscript, but I assume there have been some developments since then because it is an election year. So where are things, and is this something that you're supportive of, this third party in an active way?
Well, I think you're referring to Americans Elect
Correct.
at AmericansElect.org, which is not a third party. It is a process. It is a process that will allow a third choice in the presidential ballot. In 2012, they're in the middle of a convention now. That convention will be concluded May 15th, and May 15th there will either be a nominee or there won't, depending on who qualified. Right now, I think the situation is a little bit like the movie Field of Dreams. They have built it. They don't know if anybody's going to come. And from my perspective, I'm not, I'm not involved. I know about it, but I'm not involved in it at all. I'm not a delegate. And but I think that it could have relevance in 2014 for a potential congressional party because it facilitates access to the ballot, which is
And
the key.
how do you, I mean, again, I don't want to spend too much time on the idea of the third party, although there are, I have noticed all around, in talking to many people, that there are lots of people who have the same idea, that there is a vast number of people in the United States that are, that feel unconnected at their core to either the Democrat or the Republican point of view, and who are looking for something else. I mean, they, you know, who are kind of I don't want to call them centrists all the time, but to a certain extent, they are people who feel that neither party speaks for them. So, but do you think that since we have had such, as I think you may called it in the book at one point, a duopoly, since we've had a duopoly for so long in the United States, there hasn't really been a major third party effort since the early part of the 20th century. Even though there have been, as you pointed out, individuals who have come forward as third candidates, there hasn't been a.
There's never been a congressional third party. Third parties have always been with reference to a candidate for president, Ross Perot, Ralph Nader, whatever.
Although,
Wasn't
didn't the Green Party
1956.
before? I was going to say, did.
1956 was the last emergence of a real third party. I mean, we've had the high point after the emergence of the Republican Party in 1856 was in 1912, when a former president actually formed a party himself and ran for president. That was Theodore Roosevelt.
Right, the Bull Moose Party. But well, there was, I mean, there was the Progressive Party, La Follette, and there was certainly Norman Thomas and the Socialists had.
Yeah, their high points were 1912. Socialist high point was 1912. La
Right.
Follette ran in 1924. I think he won one state, Wisconsin. So, those were not congressional parties, though. Those were presidential parties associated with the candidate. The main point is that, we live in a time where the people's business isn't really being addressed. I mean, if you look what's happened out there to middle-income families in America, in 2010, the median income in America was the same as it was in 1996, which means there was absolutely no progress. And if you take into consideration a longer period, it's been stagnant for nearly 25, 30 years, largely because of outsourcing of jobs. 40,000 factories have closed, 6 million jobs have been lost in the last 10 years. And technology has replaced people, and you just don't need as many people. And then the downturn of labor union representation all have led to stagnant income for the middle class. That is the key issue for our country, because upward mobility is so critical to how we think of ourselves as Americans.
Well, and do you feel, I mean, this may be, I don't mean to load the question, but do you feel that with all of the challenges that face not only America but the world, that in terms of the natural resources, carbon in the atmosphere, that people who propose an alternative to the traditional growth and kind of limitless, the idea that there's a limitless growth to the economy, which is based on a seemingly limitless availability of natural resources and of a world that can accept the cost of all of that growth. The alternative to that presented by some people is a kind of sustainable growth, which is a new economy based on a different way of using natural resources. And it's not something you necessarily address, but it seems to be underlying in many ways some of the kind of geopolitical issues that you talked about. How do you, I mean, do you feel that it's possible to reorient the economy in a different direction?
Well, sustainability is an important thing and probably a necessary thing given where we are on the planet. And the book is We Can All Do Better, in which I talk about how each of us can do better, as well as how our politics can be done better. And sustainability, you have to make a decision. I decided I would talk about specifically the economy and foreign policy and the structure of our political system. So there were some things that I left out. The environment was one of them, very important, but not in the scope of this book. I think that the key point, if you were talking about sustainability as a movement, it would be okay, then they need a political aspect to that. And who's carrying the banner, and how do you grab the levers of power? I mean, you just take, for example, the difference between Tea Party and Occupy. Tea Party emerged really in 2009. And in 2010, they made a decision, and that they have very clear objective, roll back government, very clear strategy, win congressional seats. In 2010, they won 43 congressional seats. And that meant that when Speaker Boehnert and President Obama had an agreement on principle on a $3 trillion deficit reduction package in the summer of 2011, those 43, and Boehnert took the idea back to the caucus, the Tea Party Republicans in that caucus rejected it and brought the country to the brink of bankruptcy. That is how quickly things can change. So when people in America say things can't change, well, who heard of the Tea Party 2008? Nobody. And there they were. They took the country to the brink of bankruptcy. Take Occupy, on the other hand, had no political agenda. They had a great slogan, we're the 99%. They called attention to something very important, income inequality in the country. They didn't have a specific agenda, and they chose not to get involved in electoral politics. And so I say that, you know, if you care about the sustainability movement, you've got to have your lever. You have to go for getting your hands on the levers of power. And we got to remember that back in the 1960s, it not only was Dr. Martin Luther King who had a moral vision and a dream and captured the imagination of the country and the world, but it also took a skilled politician named Lyndon Johnson who knew how to use the levers of power to make Dr. King's dream permanent because it was enacted into law.
Well, and what you lead to there is the whole question of leadership. I think this is a theme throughout the book that you're looking for leadership, people who will tell the truth, who will not pander to belief systems that kind of, in a sort of demagogic way, but who will tell people what is really going on in the world around them and offer them hope and positive solutions from a political point of view.
That's exactly right, and for citizens to realize the power they possess. For example, in 2008, on that election night in Chicago, I think we made a mistake to believe that one leader can renew democracy or renew the country all by himself. And not even someone who touched our hearts as deeply as Barack Obama can do that alone. It takes citizens, it takes lieutenants, it takes sergeants, it takes people who are in the field. Citizens are the ones who will empower a leader. Just look at what happened in the Mideast last year, the Arab Spring. In a democracy today, democracy is not a vicarious experience. And we need to have, in the Internet age, and in the Internet age, there is no excuse, involved citizens that shape the direction they want their democracy to go. To the extent we have that, we get movements in the country, as we've had with the abolitionists and the suffragists and the civil rights workers and the environmentalists, that affect policy and change the country. To the extent that we don't have that because citizens are anesthetized or feel things are hopeless or don't get involved for whatever reason, the moneyed interests control. And right now we're in a period of time where the moneyed interests control this process. For example, you read in the newspapers just in the last couple of days about J.P. Morgan losing $2 billion on some kind of trades. Well, you know, the financial reform bill that was passed in 2010 was a watered down bill, and it shouldn't be surprising because the financial industry contributed $318 million to politicians in Washington during that period. The healthcare industry contributed $145 million, so it's no surprise that the healthcare bill that passed did not have a public option to compete with private insurance. And so if you don't exercise your responsibility as citizens, if you don't have a zest for that, if you don't have your own vision of what the country should be, if you don't have your own thought about what we could do to really get the country moving forward. You leave it to the moneyed interest, and the moneyed interest control the process.
Well, and of course, then that brings us to one of the core elements of what I think is our current situation, which you also talked about, which is the Citizens United case ruled by the Supreme Court, giving corporations essentially a simply made from whole cloth notion of being persons under the Constitution and subject to freedom of speech, as if and you also talked about this, the difference between an advertisement, a political advertisement, and free speech.
There's no question the Supreme Court is right at the center of the selling of government to the moneyed interest. Watergate occurred, Nixon, people carrying around cash in satchels, can't have that anymore, limits put on the amount of money that campaigns can spend and have. The Supreme Court decides that you can't limit the amount of money an individual spends in his or her own campaign, because to do so would be to limit that individual's right to free speech. In other words, equating money with speech. So to limit money, you limit speech. The result of that is that, you know, there are now 47% of the Congress and Senate that are millionaires, as opposed to 9% in the population. But if that wasn't bad enough, you then had in 2010 the Supreme Court making a decision called Citizens United that built on a decision made in the 19th century, the Robber Baron Court, that essentially said that a corporation was a person. So Citizens United, taking it to the logical absurdity, said that because a corporation is a person, you can't limit the corporation's right to free speech, and therefore you can't limit what the corporation spends on politics. The result is that this year you're going to have super PACs. The next 6 months you're going to see an orgy of money that's going to flow over the system that is going to make most citizens sick if they stop to contemplate it. And that is all courtesy of the Supreme Court. Because you have that situation, the only way you're able to limit money in politics is with a constitutional amendment. It's a very simple amendment. It simply says federal, state, and local government may limit the amount of money that they spend in a political campaign. And to me, that's the beginning of the answer. I think the next part of it is whatever the federal government, once they're allowed to limit, then the federal government should do it with public financing. For $3 billion a year out of a $3.5 trillion budget, you can take all the special interests out of politics. And then you'd have senators and congressmen who were studying the issues more, who were interacting with their constituents more, and making phone calls to strangers to get money less. And the result would be, I think, better government and a re-energized democracy.
So, and what would you say is the path? I mean, aside from, well, what's the path to getting a constitutional amendment through? I mean, that is a fairly large undertaking.
Well, that's true. That's true, but it's happened in our past. There was a time in the 19th century when corrupt state legislatures sent corrupt senators to Washington, because the state legislature was the one that selected the U.S. senator from each state. And the people rose up. And they said, no, the people should send senators, not corrupt legislatures. And a constitutional amendment process was started, and citizens became involved. And every year, for a number of years in the U.S. Senate, the vote was held and it went down. But ultimately, it passed. And so you have to have that same kind of tenacity. I mean, as I say, citizenship is not a vicarious experience, and it takes effort. But that's what democracy asks of each of us. And so what would happen is there would be a movement started to pass a constitutional amendment that would limit the amount of money spent in a campaign, or could limit the amount of money spent in a campaign. And then over, I don't know how many years, it would pass in the Congress and then be ratified in the states. And the point is it could be ratified very quickly.
Of course, you'd have to overcome the opposition, which would be the moneyed interests themselves spending as much money as they possibly could to subvert the the process. So you'd have to, I
Yeah,
mean,
and that's why only citizens can put us back on the right course.
right. Well, I think that actually, as a message, is a pretty good message. Citizen empowerment, citizen involvement, whatever your political view is. I mean, I happen to have my own sense of what that might mean. I think that more people have positive outlooks than we realize. I think, the political process is not very friendly to citizenry at this point. And,
Well, what you need is a movement that is very specific about what needs to happen in democracy. But as I said earlier, it builds on the goodness of the American people. I mean, I have a radio show on SiriusXM Satellite Radio, in which I want people to hear the kind of stories that I heard 4 years on the road in America as a politician and a basketball player. And these are stories that are about the dignity of work, and they're stories about selflessness in communities, like the guy that shined shoes at the Pittsburgh Children's Hospital for 46 years, and out of every tip he got, he put a portion of that tip into a fund to pay for poor kids' health care. And the year, the day I interviewed him, he put over $100,000 into that fund. Well, that's who I believe the American people are, and that's somebody who's positive about what can happen and what he could do to make life better for those poor kids in that Pittsburgh hospital. And that's how citizens have to think and remember that's who we are. And then we develop a positive story about what we can do as citizens together to get a government to do what it needs to do, but because of money, it hesitates to do.
what do you think? I mean, I guess, it sort of leads me inevitably to ask you, I'm sure everyone asks you this question, but why did you quit politics? Because at least for me, and I'm sure for a lot of other people, you represented a lot of hope and positivism and the belief that, someone with considerable intelligence could rise to a high level in government. And we kind of wish that you hadn't left.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I spent 20 years in politics, in the Senate, and running for president. And I believe that there's a role for citizens, and I'm a citizen, and that's something that I hope I'm a catalyst to start, because I think ultimately that is what's going to be the answer. It's not going to be given the nature of the system, absent a vast majority, it's going to take the people that get candidates in both sides to recognize what's important for the country.
So instead of asking you whether you'll run again, because I think you've already answered that question in other places, saying that you wouldn't, but would you, I mean, let's say, do you feel that in order to engender the kind of citizen involvement that you're calling for in the book, that to go beyond writing the book, you might have to create a movement or, some sort of, almost even if it was just a kind, I don't want to call it a think tank, but this, and I, some sort of an organization that would foster and grow a new a crop of leaders who are citizen based and citizen responsible. Is that something that interests you?
Well, it's a very sure. That's something I could be involved with. That's a very interesting idea, I think. Right now, all I've done is write the book. It's a result of a lot of think, a lot of thought, and caring about the country. But there are any number of citizen movements out there that have been moribund, or organizations that were established to tap citizens. And the real question is, can we get the media involved? Can citizens themselves overcome the cynicism of the media and the people who work and live in Washington? And ultimately, I think they can. And maybe I have a role there to talk about it as I'm doing now. And then you find a lot of other people who can come in and be a part of it. And that's a very interesting prospect. I haven't made any decisions about anything other than the book right now.
Well, I imagine that if, as you go around the country, you'll talk to a lot of people who want to hear from you, but also gives you an opportunity to hear what people are saying. It might be.
Well, that's the point. You know, it's a two-way street. Just like people always say, the communication is from the leader to the people. Well, that's true, but it goes the other way too. It goes from the citizen to the leader. And as I'm trying to say in the book, that's the most powerful communication of all.
Right, no, I agree. I think the leaders without the voice of the citizenry heard in and through the leaders, then it isn't
And
really a democracy.
one of the things that I'm trying to do is trigger a discussion about this. If you want to follow on Twitter, basically it's at Bill Bradley, hashtag do better. And I want people to join and say what they think we could do better, what they could do better.
No, I think that's really a good idea. Well, what I will ask of you perhaps is, and I can do this through your
I gotta go now.
all right, through your staff, I'll ask you to send a report back maybe after you've done this. Well, thank you so much for doing this, Senator Bill Bradley. I really enjoyed We Can All Do Better, and I hope that others will as well.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.